December 1.
All right. Good evening, everybody. It's good to see you. Happy Hanukkah to one and all. It's wonderful. I'm sorry that we're not doing it in person, but I am glad that at least we can learn something over Hanukkah. And that's what I do want to talk about this evening. Typically, we talk about the blessings and the prayers, but I'm going to focus on a particular prayer that we say on Hanukkah. So we'll get to that. But before I do that, I want to start with something that I saw a few years ago, that every now and then I like to learn from different svarim, from different books. And I love just an eclectic nature of different viewpoints and insights on Torah and Torah. And every now and then I come across one that I have to pause and say, what? Huh? What are you talking about? So I came across one a couple of years ago, and I'm going to give you the distilled version. I'll spare you all of the mental gymnastics it took me to figure it out, but it's very cool. I don't know truthfully the full meaning behind it, but it's a fascinating concept. Allow me the following. There's a verse much towards the very end of the Torah, where it talks in two places in the Torah, where it talks about if we follow the commandments, then things will be good. And if we turn away from the Torah, if we disregard God's commandments, then unfortunate calamities can and unfortunately have befallen the Jewish people. Well, it's known as the Tochacha, or in when I was in yeshiva, they call it the Tochacha. It's totally, the emphasis is on the wrong syllables. But the correct word is Tochacha, which means reproof, rebuke. Here's the deal, gentlemen, ladies. Follow me, God says, thumbs up. Don't follow me, look out. So in the second place in the Torah where it talks about it, it gives the positive. If you follow the commandments, it uses an expression. It says, Elyon, the Jewish people will be Elyon. Elyon means raised above. Al kol goyei haaretz, over all the nations of the earth. Meaning the Jewish people will be considered at the top as the model, the role model, and the example for all of the other nations to follow to learn what's proper. Because we're living it, we're doing it, God says you will be considered Elyon al kol haaretz, the high point raised above all the others. The hand, right? If you want to reach for something way, way, way up, you use your hand and you reach as far as you can. That is the highest point at which a person can reach. Of the arm, it's the hand itself that is literally the very top of a person. When you're stretched out, that's what reaches all the way to the top. So if you examine the rabbi, the scholar that I'm sharing this with you from, is known by the name of the book he wrote. He wrote a book called Ben Ish Chai, literally means the son of a living man. And it's based on a verse. But the name of his book was the Ben, and he's known, he was a Svardic scholar, a Svardic rabbi who lived in Baghdad. He was the leading scholar in Baghdad. And he shares this following, and what I'm sharing with you comes from him. He says that if you look at the hand, it's a fascinating structure. What makes this uniquely human, right? We always talk about the opposing thumb, right? No other creature has this kind of structure of the hand. But what's interesting is that it's really divided into two groups. You have your four that pretty much, okay, one or some of them are taller than the other, but they go as a unit, the four, and then the thumb is off to the side as a, almost like an independent, in fact, it works independently. I don't know about you, but I have the hardest time with the fourth finger. It's hard for me to work the fourth one without having some interplay with the others. But okay, you can all start playing with your fingers. That's fine. But that's fine, right? But you do have a of a structure. Okay, it's four and one. That's how the hand is separated. He writes the following. I'll give you a little background. I had the opportunity so far over Hanukkah to share with a few people, Liz included, of that if you ever take a look at the song that we sing after lighting the menorah, in Hebrew, we call it Ma'oz Tzor. In English, I think it's called Rock of Ages. Ma'oz Tzor. So it's a beautiful song, and it's been sung for a very long time, very way, 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 way back tradition. But what is it? So if you have the opportunity, let me say that better, seize the opportunity tonight, or if you don't do it tonight because it's so late and I'm going to hurt your brain cells, I will give you a pass. But tonight is the fourth night of Hanukkah. You have four more days to look this up. Read the entire story. Read the entire song. What you will find is that there are six stanzas, and it basically is a recap of Jewish history. In general Judaic literature, in much of Judaic literature, we're told that the Jewish people will go through four root exiles. It's not for tonight to get into where this comes from, and I'm sure we will find opportunities to talk about it. But trust me, four root exiles that the Jewish people go through. The first is after the destruction of the first temple by the Babylonians. So the first exile is known as exile of Babel, Babylonia. The next one, which is the Purim story, takes place in Persia. That's the story of Haman and King Ahasuerus and the heroes of Mordechai and Esther. Okay, that's known as Gullet, the exile of Persia. Then comes the third exile, which is interesting that we refer to it as an exile, is the story of Hanukkah with the Greeks coming in and defiling the temple. They did not destroy it. That's myth number 27 on my list. They did not destroy the temple. They defiled it. They made it impure. They tried to spiritually take away the spirituality of the place. That's known as the exile of Greece, Yavan in Hebrew. And then the fourth is what happens a little bit after that story of Hanukkah, of when the Romans come and destroy the second temple. And that's the exile we currently still find ourselves in until the coming of Mashiach. Okay, that's the basic outline of Jewish history. Starts in Egypt. That's the root of the Jewish people going into trouble. That's the root, so to say. And then from them come the four branches of the four exiles of Babylonia, Persia, Greece, and Rome. If you read your story of the song of Ma'oz Tzor, you will see that the six stanzas, the first is a general introduction. Then the second paragraph is about the Egyptian servitude. And then the last four paragraphs are these four exiles, where it's a paragraph about Babylonia. The fourth one is Persia. The fifth one is Greece. And the sixth one is Rome. Those are your six stanzas of the story of the Song of Ma'oz Tzor. Okay? File it away. Take a look at it. It's really worthwhile. Okay. Why do I share that with you? Is because this is what the Ben Ish Chai, this great Baghdadi scholar, wrote. He says that the hand represents the interplay of the Jewish people, the thumb, against, so to say, the four exiles, the four fingers. This is the concept, he says. It's not a strange concept to me, because generally speaking, the Jewish people are known as a nation that dwells alone. That dwells. It's a verse in the Torah. Badad yeshev, that they will sit and dwell alone. They will never, ever, ever become so assimilated into whatever culture they find themselves to the point of obliteration. We've come close a few times, unfortunately, but never to the point of extinction. It's an impossibility. Again, file it away. I'm going to throw a lot at you. The hand, therefore, represents the four exiles for the Jewish people. Okay? Now, what's fascinating is why did the Ben Ishchai decide that that's the structure? Look at your hand. What makes the thumb different than the other four fingers? One aspect of it is that the other four fingers have three joints. Your thumb only has two. You ever notice that?
Never.
And if you did notice it, did you even bother to wonder why? Yeah. There is nothing in the design of a human being or any creature or the world or the universe that's a coincidence. Everything is structured for a meaning, for a purpose. If you think about it, it's a very nice symbol. The Jewish people have only two levels, us and God. As we've said many, many times, we have no intermediaries. We do not believe in anything between us and God. We have a direct relationship. No human being, no prophet, no other power. It is a direct relationship of the Jewish people to God. The other nations of the world have intermediaries, whether it's a prophet, whether it's another deity, whether it's some kind of human that has godly qualities, but it's three levels. The direct link between them and their God is always through someone or something. That's why it represented with three joints, one, two, and three. The person, the intermediary, and the God. The Jewish people only have two, them and God. Fascinating structure, okay? No intermediary. In fact, here's where it gets funky. What's the Hebrew word for the thumb? Anybody? Monroe.
That was Monroe.
I'm disappointed, but I can't read too harsh on you. It's not a word in the Torah itself. I don't think it's a word in the Torah. So I'll give you a bye.
I'm all thumbs right now.
The Hebrew word for thumb is egodel. Egodel. If you want to know in Hebrew, and it's important why I'm going to spell it for you, is Aleph, Gimel, Vav, Dalid, Lamed. Egodel. Egodel or egudel. Okay? Rav Hirsch writes that the word for thumb, egodel, is related to the word aguda. Aguda means that which is bound, tied together, a togetherness. Some of you may be familiar. There's an organization known as the Aguda, Agudas Yisrael of America. Why is it called the Aguda? It's because it's the organization that brings together all the different components, all the different communities, all the different synagogues, hence the word aguda. Okay? What combines your hand to make it into one is your thumb. The thumb is that which can go, watch this, which is the tallest, right? It's not the thumb. The thumb on this particular format, when I have my hand open like this, the thumb is the lowest of the fingers. Watch this. Right? When I put them all together, can you see it? Right? You do it on your own hand. It's nothing fantastic. Your thumb becomes the tallest. Mm-hmm. Your thumb becomes the top. It's not a coincidence. The way this is structured is purposely done, so that the thumb can be all the way to the bottom or all the way to the top. There is no middle ground. You notice that? Your thumb can't be somewhere in the middle unless you're like in the process. But if your hand is open, your thumb is at the lowest. And when your hand is closed, right, your thumb is at the top. Does that not describe the Jewish people? Look over any point in our history. We're either at the top or we're at the bottom. There is no middle ground. That's just the nature of who we are. Again, I've said this many times, and I'll say it again in case someone's listening for the first time and may never listen to me again. I am not suggesting that it's an elitist view. That's not what's being suggested here. I don't believe in that concept. I believe that the Jewish people have been given a greater responsibility in the world. And hence, we are endowed with an ability to reach the highest levels, or use it in the negative terms and be at the lowest levels. That's just look through Jewish history. All the isms of the world over time, very, very often, there's a large percentage. I would say an extremely, doesn't make sense, the number of Jews that are in the forefront of all of these movements. Some are very positive movements that have changed the world for the better, and some have brought the world down to levels that we never want to see again. Jews are in the forefront of it because we're the thumb. We're either down or we're up. It's one of the two. Okay. The word Elyon, I told you that in the where the Torah says that if the Jewish people will follow the commandments and be the correct role model to the world, they will be Elyon. Okay? Elyon can be broken up into two words. Elyon is spelled Ayin Lamed, Yud, Vav, and final Nun. Elyon. If you break it into two words, it spells the word Ayin Lamed, which is Al, which means upon. The last three letters, Yud, Vav, and final Nun, spell the word Yavan, Greece. Al Yavan. Overpowering Yavan, Greece. It's almost an allusion to the fact that there will come a time of where there will be a Greek exile, and the Jewish people will have a miraculous victory over the Greeks. That's the story of Hanukkah. But why specifically this particular exile? I told you there are four of them. Why isn't it Al-Bavel over Babylonia, or Al-Edom over Rome? Why is it specifically Greece? So it's phenomenal. It's really phenomenal. Who won the war against the Greeks? Who won the war? The great Jewish army, the IDF of Israel, right? Wrong. It was a small group of scholars. And you know what? You know what lineage they came from? Anybody? They were Kohanim. The Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, were all Kohanim. They were Kohanim. Okay, that's interesting. What's the significance? If you look for the very first occurrence of the word Elyon in the Torah, I've said this before, and it's not my concept, but many, many, many authorities tell us that if you want to get to the essence of a word, find its first occurrence in the Torah. For example, the word tov is good, right? The word tov is good. Where's the first occurrence of it? Where it says, and Hashem saw, right, that what he did was good. Okay, that gives you an indication that tov is obviously a good thing. Okay, it's for that reason that the letter tet, right, the ninth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is a symbol of goodness because it represents, that's the first occurrence of the letter tet in the Torah, which is the word tov. So where do we find this first word of Elyon? We find it in the story of a king by the name of Malki Tzedek. Malki Tzedek came out and greeted Abraham and brought him food, brought him wine in appreciation of the victory that Abraham had just secured. And fascinatingly enough, he calls him Kohen Le'el Elyon. He calls Abraham, or Melchizedek is referred to as the Kohen, the priest for God Almighty. The family of Kohanim will be the ones to achieve Elyon, that prominence of being successful, of overcoming, becoming the top Al Yavon, specifically in the story of when the Jews have to fight against Yavon, the Greeks. That's the hint. Yes, we've experienced four exiles. Thank God we've succeeded in overcoming three of them. We await the fourth. There's no more Babylon. When's the last time you went to the store and you bumped into a Babylonian? Anytime recently? I don't know. Maybe where you guys live. There's none here in Baltimore. Guaranteed. Right? When's the last time that you actually, you know, a Persian that's, you know, obviously we have Persians who come from Persia, from Iran. There's certainly a lot of Jews that come from it. But it's not a superpower that's going to be, you know, walking down the street and identify accordingly. Yes, there are Greeks out there that come from the country of Greece, right? But again, it's not a superpower. Rome was still waiting. Rome is still a very big player in world politics. But okay, the point I'm trying to make is that the hand is the symbol to always remember that the Jewish people, the thumb, an opposing thumb to the four kingdoms, the four superpowers that have tried to eradicate us. We have, unfortunately, the ability to fall to the bottom or to the top. It depends on what we're going to do. If we follow what Hashem asks of us, he tells us we will be Elyon. We will reach the top, as was exemplified in the story of Hanukkah, where just a small group, all of 13 people took down the great Greek Syrian army. Okay. In the prayer, we're going to segue here. In the prayer that we add for Hanukkah is known as Al Hanisim. We add it into our Amidah, into our Shmona Esrei, three times a day. And if you wash on bread and you bench afterwards, we add it in the benching, in the Berkat HaMazon, the grace after meals. In both of those places, we add the paragraph Al Hanisim that talks about Hanukkah. We do it also on Purim as it relates to Purim. But what's interesting is that in that paragraph, and I'll just read it to you quickly. I think most of you are familiar with it, but just give me a moment and I'll read it to you so we have familiarity. It's right after the Modim prayer. It says, and for the miracles and for the salvation and for the mighty deeds and for the victories and for the battles which you performed for our forefathers in those days at this time. In the days of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Hasmoneim, and his sons, when the wicked Greek kingdom rose up against your people Israel to make them forget your Torah and compel them to stray from the statutes of your will, you in your great mercy stood up for them in the time of their distress. You took up their grievance, judged their claim, and avenged their wrong. You delivered the strong into the hands of the weak, the many into the hands of the few, the impure into the hands of the pure, the wicked into the hands of the righteous, and the wanton into the hands of the diligent students of your Torah. For yourself, you made a great and holy name in your world, and for your people Israel, you worked a great victory and salvation as this very day. Listen to this line. Thereafter, your children came to the Holy of Holies of your house, cleansed your temple, purified the site of your holiness, and kindled lights in the courtyards of your sanctuary, and they established these 8 days of Hanukkah to express thanks and praise to your great name. Right? It's pretty much a good story about what we know about the story of Hanukkah. But I want to point out two things. Number one, who is the hero in that paragraph? Obviously, God. Okay? In human terms, Who is the human being who plays front and center that role in the story of Hanukkah? Who would you choose? It's not a trick question.
Judas Maccabee?
Did I mention Judah Maccabee anywhere?
Was the Matityahu?
Matityahu, right. Matityahu. Matityahu. Okay.
The priest.
He was what?
The priests.
Correct.
The okay.
Correct. The Chashmonaim, the priest, that's correct. But again, I'll read you the opening line. In the days of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, the high priest, the Hasmonean, and his sons, and then we go off and tell the whole story. Okay? Matityahu is the hero. But what's his father's name? Oh, we know his name was Yochanan. And he also fought this war together with his sons. It's interesting. It gives us three generations of information. Yochanan did not fight. The grandfather did not fight in this war. He's mentioned in it. It's Matisyo and his sons who fought the war. But yet we mention Matisyo's father, Yochanan. Why?
Because he's the one who trained his sons to
follow each other. So why stop with Yochanan? Go back two more generations or four more generations. You can go all the way back to Aaron. He's the father of all the Kohanim. I'll show you the contrast. Let's look at the story on the other paragraph when we say Al HaNisim for Purim. Who do you expect to be the heroes there? Mordechai and Esther.
Esther. Yeah.
Right? Mordechai and Esther. Here's what it says. In the days of Mordechai and Esther in Shushan, the capital, when Haman, the wicked, rose up against them and da-da-da-da, and it tells the whole story. Does it give any genealogy?
No.
Doesn't tell us who Mordechai's father was, although the Megillah does. There's no mention of it in the prayer of Al HaNisim. It just says who the heroes are. So what is it that in the story of Hanukkah, we're now told about three generations? Wow, great, wonderful. Ladies and gentlemen, the essence of this holiday is family, continuity of Jewish family. That is the essence of this holiday. I'll show you where I'm getting this from. It's an important, important idea. What does the word Hanukkah mean?
Dedication.
Dedication. That is correct. Because when they beat the Greeks and they went back and they rededicated the temple for service. They didn't rebuild it. They rededicated it. Now, you're right, Monroe. It does mean to dedicate. But the truth is that if you want to look at it from a purely etymological perspective, what's the etymology of the word? Ches nun chaf chanech chinuch means educate. Doesn't really mean dedicate. It's borrowed because that's what it is we are dedicating this information to the next generation. But chinuch means educate. The holiday of Hanukkah is the holiday of the centrality of educating, making sure that the traditions are passed from generation to generation, from parents to children. The victory that they were able to have against the Greek army was because it was Yochanan, Matisyahu, and his children. It was a continuity of multiple generations. Making sure. So yes, you're right, Michelle. It's because he taught it. And you're right. The list can go all the way back to Aaron. That's true. But I need to emphasize it. Generally speaking, three is the magic number. When you talk about something, think about a string. If you have a string, what makes the difference between a string and a cord?
The third piece.
That's correct. You take three strings and you bind them together, it becomes not just three times as strong. It becomes almost unbreakable. It's called the three-ply bond. That's what's being asked here. David, I see your hand up. You're on mute.
Sorry. So the your discussion about chinuch and I don't know if this is too esoteric, but the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a book that was written by a father for his child, which enumerates the 613 mitzvahot as a teaching of the mitzvahot and the understandings of those mitzvahot to the child, and it exists today as a reference in the Jewish.
Yeah, that's exactly why he named it Sefer HaChinuch, the book of education, because it is the compendium of all the sources and rationales behind all 613 mitzvahs. Okay, but what I want to show you is the following. What did the Greeks have a problem with here? You see, what I want to point out to you is this concept of continuity of our traditions is something that the Greeks were very vehemently against. And I'll show you. The Greeks, again, they did not destroy the temple. So what did they really do? They defiled it. What does that mean? It's a nice English word. But in practical terms, what did they do? They walked in and they did what?
But they tried to change it from a house of worship to a barn. They brought in animals. They destroyed the symbols of the tradition. They wanted Jews to assimilate. They did not want them to
exactly.
be Jews.
That's correct. So if you're let's put on your Greek hat for the moment. Okay, I'm not asking anyone to put on togas, just a plain Greek hat. Okay, and all you got to do is tell me what laws are you going to enact. That's going to just walk in and make the temple a barn. That's not going to, how's that going to change the whole religion? You have to come down and make laws to forbid certain things.
Right. Well, What did they forbid?
The three
teaching Hebrew, reading Torah.
Reading Torah.
Circumcision.
What was that? Somebody said something.
Circumcision, Britain.
Circumcision is correct. Circumcision was one that they outlawed.
Sabbath
was number two, and there's one more which I wouldn't have guessed, but now I think about it. When you learn about it, it makes sense. Rosh Chodesh, the fact that we use a lunar calendar. All three. Yes, you're right that they tried to water down what Torah is, but I want to be careful here. They did not outlaw the learning of Torah. They did not do that. The Romans did that. The Greeks did not. The Greeks wanted to create a bookshelf, so to say, that had on it equal philosophies. The philosophy of Plato, the philosophy of,
Socrates.
And there's also a book. There's another book of wisdom with philosophy called the Torah. And there's another book. And they're all the same. Just they're all books of philosophy and wisdom. There was nothing more. The Torah didn't offer anything more than any other book of philosophy in their minds. So they didn't outlaw the study of Torah, but they tried to neuter it of what spiritual benefit it provides. But they targeted these three mitzvahs: the mitzvah of Shabbos, the mitzvah of Milah, of circumcision, and Rosh Chodesh. Why these three? What you'll find is the common theme that runs through all of them is it hits exactly on this concept of continuity of family tradition. Watch. Let's start with Rosh Chodesh. We'll start with the new moon. Start with the hardest one. Okay? What we find, and what makes Judaism unique in regards to how we calculate time and the calendar is just for contrast, the Christian calendar, the Gregorian calendar, is a solar calendar. It is based exclusively on the sun, the cycles of the sun vis-a-vis the earth and all the other constellations. How long it rotates and all of that, that's how you have your months, January through December. It's based on the solar, it's based on the sun. That's why the seasons are the way they are. On the other side, the polar opposite is Islam. the Muslim calendar is a lunar calendar. It is based exclusively on the moon. That is the reason why Ramadan, their holiest holiday, is always 11 days earlier than it was the previous year. Because the lunar calendar has only 354 days, the solar calendar has 365, difference of 11 days. That's why Ramadan can go through all the different seasons. It just keeps moving back 11 days every single year. So it can start in spring, and then it moves to winter, and then to fall, and then to summer, and then back to spring. The Jewish calendar is a hybrid. I know typically we call ourselves based on the lunar cycle, which is 99% true. There's one tiny little verse in the Torah. It's just one of many verses. It's overlooked, but it does cause us to reconsider. And I feel like sometimes when we're trying to calculate things and we're looking at the calendar, I feel like ways when we're lost. Recalculating. Like, how do we figure this out again? Well, the one verse in the Torah that throws the monkey wrench is that the Torah demands that the holiday of Pesach, of Passover, must be in the spring. Right. It's called Chodesh Ha'aviv, the month of the spring, which means you have to consider the sun because seasons are tied to the sun, not the moon, which explains why, you see, we Jews, it's go big or go home. That's the way we function, right? Yeah, in the Gregorian calendar, you need to have a leap year. All right, we'll throw you a bone once every 4 years. We'll give you a day. The Jews, you make a leap year. Oh my God, we're throwing a whole month into this thing. We got a whole, oh yeah. And you know which month? Adar, party, what once, twice. Okay, that's how we do it. Go big or go home. But the reason for it is very simple, is because remember, every year the lunar calendar loses 11 days against the solar calendar. So approximately 7 out of 19 years, approximately every 3 years or so, is a leap year because you lost 11, then 22, and then you're at 33. You need a whole month to get back on track to keep Passover in the spring. Just by a show of hands, how many of you did not know this?
I didn't.
Good. Okay, great. And I'm assuming all of you that aren't showing me your faces all had your hand up. Okay, great. Okay. So Rosh Chodesh, you find the fascinating aspect. The Jewish people are compared to the moon. In many, many, many sources of Judaic literature, the Jewish people are compared to the moon, not the sun. And the commentators wonder, why is that? What do we have in common with the moon? The most obvious is that what makes the moon different than the sun is that it constantly waxes and wanes. It's got its ups and it's got its downs. Hey, we just talked about this in Jewish history. We have our moments of where we're focused, we're doing the right thing, and things are moving along the right trajectory. You have a King Solomon who's able to build the first temple, and things are doing great. And then you have many, many generations of where we fall to the bottom, and there's disunity, and we go, okay, it's waxing and waning, up and down throughout history. But what most many commentators point out is that there's something even more fascinating about the moon that is the appropriate symbol for the Jewish people. It's called the ability to grow, the power of renewal. How often, we know this already just because we've advanced with science, but if you were to watch the moon for the first time, you would be panic-stricken as the month was coming to an end. It's getting less and less and less, and then OMG, it's gone. But then that little sliver of the moon starts again, and it grows, and it becomes a full moon when all heck breaks loose, right? Because that's the power of renewal. The sun is the present. It is what it is. What you see is what you get. Yesterday, today, tomorrow, it's all the same. The moon is always in motion. It's always in what's tomorrow going to be. Is it an up? Is it a down? But it's going somewhere. The eye is always on the future. That's why the Jewish people are compared to the moon. We don't live for the here and now. We live in the here and now, but we don't live for it. We live for a future. The whole concept of Rosh Chodesh, where Hashem tells us you are to calculate your entire calendar, your existence of time, is an eye towards the future, not the here and now. Which is a great segue, which is why Shabbos was their second law that they had a prohibition against. The whole concept of Shabbos is I have a time that I work, but why am I working? Because I have a purpose. I have a goal in mind. It's not just to make money. It's because I'm here for a reason. I'm here to accomplish something in this world. You know what reminds me of that every single week? Shabbos. Shabbos reminds me, why am I working my tochas off every day? It's not because I want to only achieve in the realm of work. I have a purpose. I have what to add. I have a reason why God created me. I have something to bring and to offer this world. Shabbos is known as Me'ein Olam Haba. It's a little bit of a taste of the world to come. You notice that? I think I've shared this with you. You know, in the laws of kosher, there's a ratio where something still retains its identity and has a significance. It's 1 to 60. I'll give you an example. I've shared this, I think, in the past of where I love to make on Friday, I make my cholent, right? My beef stew for Shabbos. Yeah, that's my job. Right? Mrs. T makes all the other delicious stuff. My job is cholent on Friday. Okay. So making my cholent, and apologize for to the vegetarians in the room. I enjoy the meat in my cholent. Okay. That's my thing. So I make my meat cholent and it's boiling and it's bubbling and it's great. And I lift the pot cover off. I want to check it before Shabbos begins to make sure it's got enough water in it. It's got the right smell. Ah, does it need a little more salt? And I lift the pot cover over. I lift it up. And just at that moment, a grandchild walks in and trips. And he or she is holding a cup of milk with no lid. And the milk goes everywhere. And a drop of milk lands precariously right in my cholent.
But you can't mix milk and meat.
But you can't mix milk and meat. Rabbi, yeah. I love you dearly, but you're not going to eat it, are you? The answer is it depends. Okay,
just a little bit.
It depends. In halacha, in Jewish law, if it's more than a 1 to 60 ratio, meaning there's more than 60 times the amount of cholent vis-a-vis that one drop of milk, then the milk becomes insignificant. And it's as if it's gone. It doesn't exist. And yes, Candy, I will enjoy that cholent 100% guilt-free.
But Rabbi, won't you take a spoon and take that little bit out?
No. I chose the example of milk because you can't get it out. It's liquid that becomes absorbed. If it were something that just is a solid that just happens to land on it and I can remove it, I will. But a little drop of milk, it is going to become so a part of that cholent you before you blink. If it's more than a 60-to-1 ratio, it becomes insignificant. And for all intents and purposes, null and void. Our sages use this concept of a 1-to-60 ratio, which means it still retains a taste, a something, a significance. It still has as the last remaining remnant of it, that 1-to-60 ratio. For example, the Talmud says that a dream that a person has is 1/60th of prophecy. Doesn't guarantee that your dream is prophetic, but if you want to get a taste of some kind of message that was conveyed to some prophets, it could be like a dream. If you want to get a sense of what death is like, go to sleep. Sleep is 1/60th of death. Because think about it. When you're in good REM sleep, you got no idea what's going on, right? Your soul actually leaves you, gets a recharge like the Tesla. You just plug it in, gets a little spiritual recharge every morning, every night, right? You know what? I'm sharing this with you. Shabbos, says the Talmud, is 1/60th of what the world to come will be like. That's the analogy, the ratio. Shabbos has a flavor of what the world to come will be like. Olam haba. You can taste it. If you follow and absorb all that Shabbos has to offer, you can taste it. You have my chulent, you'll know what I'm talking about. That's me'ein olam. That's what the world took. No, you can do better than that. But you get a sense of what can be gained of that spiritual bliss that one can truly feel if one takes Shabbos seriously. In our songs that we sing on Shabbos, we have a connection again about family. We sing a song, Hashomer Shabbat, Habein Im Habat. Hashomer Shabbos, the one who observes Shabbos, who's that? Habein Im Habat, the son with the daughter. It's a family unit. It's a structure. Similarly, Diror Yikra, Lebein Im Bat, with son and with daughter. Shabbos has a family flavor to it. Why? Because it's the same concept. There is no greater way to have a continuity of our traditions than families who sit and do Shabbos. Not necessarily the whole Shabbos, whatever. Shabbos. Then you get it. Rosh Chodesh is an eye on the future. Shabbos is an eye on the future with a focus on family unit. And needless to say, circumcision, the third one that they outlawed, is all about a covenant that has been established since the time of Abraham of all offspring to have that. All children, 8 days old, all boys, even alluded to, not alluded to, it's outright in the verse where Hashem says, Ata, you, v'zaracha acharecha, and your seed after you, ledorotam, for all generations. Beini uvein nechem, between me and you, God says, uvein zaracha acharecha, and all of your offspring after you, himo lachem kol zachar, you shall circumcise every male. These are the three mitzvahs that the Greeks specifically targeted. Why? Because it's all about Jewish continuity. Yeah, you guys want to learn Torah? We're all for philosophy. That's fine. We should have philosophy parties and philosophy debates. Great. You take Socrates, you take Aristotle, you take Plato, and you take Torah, whatever you want to call it. Moses, you know? That's it. Hanukkah is the celebration that's dedicated to strengthening that chain of tradition from generation to generation that the Greeks sought to break. They didn't tear down the temple. They wanted to treat it like any other building. It's not unique. It doesn't have a spiritual component that you guys have traditions that you pass down. No, I don't go for that. Hanukkah, when we stand before our little menorah and we light that little flame, that's all it is. You think about it. What's a little candle, a little flame burning? You want to know how powerful it is? Turn off the lights. Turn off your lights. But Rabbi, it's so dark. I can't see what I'm doing. Yeah, light a little candle. Light a little flame. A little inspiration to rededicate ourselves to what these principles are. That's really what I think is overlooked sometimes about Hanukkah. And that's the reason why in the prayer that we add for Hanukkah, in the Al HaNisim prayer, we purposely on Hanukkah, in contrast to Purim and any other holiday, We focus on the genealogy, the lineage. Who's the hero? Matityo, because he had a father who taught him and he had children who followed him as well. That's what we rededicate ourselves on Hanukkah. To me, that is, like I said, that's an important message that needs to be conveyed. And each one of us has the ability, whether our children are older, our children, we have children, grandchildren, friends, neighbors. It's not literal to our naturally born children. It means a rededication to make sure that all of the next generation of Jews understand these concepts, understand these traditions, and understand the beauty that's there. What we all fought for to be to this point. Think about the odds on December 1st, 2021, it's a bunch of Jews from different cities and now at this point, different countries. Thank you, Sharon, right? Mm-hmm. Right? All getting together to study Torah on Hanukkah. Like what are the odds? Yeah, the odds are against us, but that's what we fight for. And that's what we rededicate every time we light this menorah. That's what it should remind us. Questions? Can't be. Is this my Hanukkah gift? No, my Hanukkah gift is spending an hour with each of you. That was my gift. What do you think? You like the idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is merit.
Yeah, thanks. All right.
I was going to say, Rabbi, I was thinking with your hand, when you close your hand and you put your thumb up and you just deal with you and God and you don't let the other things get in the way, then you're tall. When you allow everything else in, then you're
beautiful.
Not.
Beautiful. Love it. Love it. I love it. It's fascinating. Once you bring me back to it, I can't stop. Right? The word I told you for thumb is egodel. So it comes from, like I said, aguda. Aguda means that which is bound. But the word aguda, fascinating. If you have a pen handy, you'll appreciate this. Write down the following five letters. I'm going to spell the word aguda. Aleph. Gimel. Vav. Dalid. And Hey. Aguda. You will note, Aleph, skip the bays, Gimel, Dalid, Hey, and Vav. But it's missing the bays. It's Aleph, forget the bays, Gimel, Dalid, Hey, Vav, in order. I don't mean in order, but I mean those are the first letters of the Hebrew alphabet. The Maharal tells us that the reason why Aguda, which means to bring together, is missing the bays. Because if you took a class, I recommend highly, there's a class about the Hebrew letters. Hey, out there on the net somewhere, right? If you remember about the letter bays, yeah. Bays was all about multitude, many. That's why the Torah starts, the first word is Bereishis. It starts with a bays. Because the world in which we exist is about multiplicity, duality. If you want to talk about aguda, bringing things together, uniting them, you can't have a bays in it. You have to leave the bays out. Aleph, skip the bays. Gimel, Dalet, Hey, Vav. Bring them all together and leave your bays off. The word in Hebrew for locust, you all know this from your 10 plagues. Hebrew, it's called Arba. Arba were the locusts, the plague, right? Yes. Arba comes from the word many, multitude, a swarm. That's the Hebrew word for locust. swarm, many. It's the only species that Talmud tells us that has no built-in leader. It has no king. Bees have the queen bee. Ants have their whatever the leader is. The locusts have no leader. It's absolute chaos because that's multiplicity. There's no way to bind them and have them work cohesively. That's because that's the nature of multiplicity. That's the letter bays. Arba, many, swarm. Therefore, if you want to talk about aguda, binding, unifying, the letter you leave out is the letter bays. Hence, your thumb is built on that concept. Egodel is that which binds. I'm just throwing stuff at you now. You can play with it however you want.
Well, I think this was a good choice to go with this one.
Yeah.
This clip. Thank you.
It's a little out there. It's a little out there. All right. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful rest of Hanukkah, a beautiful Shabbos. And let me just make sure. Well, give me 1 second. Let's confirm. Yes, next week we are good, God willing. I would love to be back in person. So if you're able to make it, let's try and do it. I will send out a reminder just to make sure. But I really would love to see everybody who can come in person, if doable. Feel better, Michelle.
Thank you.
Greg, I'm glad you're doing better as well.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Sharon, when are you coming back?
We leave Sunday afternoon. So we'll be back Sunday night. I'll be back at school on Monday. No guarantee your eyes will be open, but I will be back at school on Monday.
Great. Wonderful. Safe travels.
Safe travels.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Have a great Hanukkah, everybody, and a wonderful night.
Thank you. Happy Hanukkah.